Very good. another talk. So, carrying on from what I taught yesterday morning, we're teaching how to be aware of your body and learning how to relax your body. So your body gets very peaceful and very at ease. Because if you can't relax your body, there's not going to be much of a chance of relaxing your mind and getting some peace. There was a gentleman which I met many years ago, and he was a psychologist at not Berkeley. What's the other one down there? What? No, just south of Stanford. Thank you. At Stanford University, and a very wealthy that university. So when meditation was starting to become popular, he was giving a bunch of money to do some research. And his experiment, he got a number of psychology students at Stanford, and he decided to split them up randomly into two groups, a control group and the victims. I don't know if that's the right word in psychology, the victims, but you know what I mean. And he sent the half of his group to a meditation retreat for the day. And the other half, the control group, he sent to a high-class Californian spa for the day. So half of the group were sitting there watching their breath with a straight back, and the other half were having massages and hot baths. And at the end of the day, they did a standard test of all the participants to see how relaxed each one was. And the results were conclusive. Without a doubt, those people who went to the Californian spa were far more relaxed than those who went to do a retreat. What the heck are you guys doing on a retreat? But that's their retreats. Here in Jhana Grove, I reckon we'll beat those Californian spas. No trouble at all. Because there was something wrong there, and something I thought, hey, what are you doing there? What type of meditation is that you're doing? Because if you're more tight, more tense afterwards, what are we up to here? Because it's not just your body, it becomes your mind becomes tight and tense too. And sometimes when people ask me, they said, well, how do I know if I'm making progress in my meditation? You go and ask the people you live with, the ones who have to put up with you, the ones you work with. And you'll find that if the meditation is really working, they'll be so amazed and surprised. On one of these retreats, a couple of years ago, here in Jhana Grove, one of these execs, I use the example of executives because they're high stress, and so that they came here for a retreat, a 9-day retreat, and they told me, she said she had to grovel and beg her boss for the time off. Even though she was due some holidays, but you know, business was really, really tough, and she was really needed, and so she begged and groveled and begged, and finally her boss gave in, so she came here. But then, after she returned to work, after the retreat was over, she sent me this wonderful email. She said, as soon as I turned up to work on Monday morning, the boss took one look at me. And he wasn't a Buddhist, you know, he was just he was of the dollar religion, worshipped the dollar. And so there he took one look at me, she said, and remarked, said, I don't know what drug they're giving you over in Perth. I don't care, but bring me back some next time. Because for him, it looked like, you know, she was happy, really happy, and bright, alert, productive. Why? He thought it could only be some sort of drug, some chemicals. And of course, it wasn't chemicals at all. It's just the power of this meditation to relax you and empower you. And so people see that straight away. Even, this is years ago. I used to go and give blood at the Red Cross. And then I was there with one of these other young monks. And then I was just next to him when they were doing his blood pressure test. And the nurse, because he'd given blood before when he was working. And the nurse, you know, took a step back and said, "Hey, according to our records, you're a regular blood donor," this other monk, and said, "but your blood pressure has gone way down." And then before giving the monk a chance to answer, you know, she looked at him and said, "You're a monk," which is pretty obvious. He says, "You haven't been meditating, have you?" "Yeah, of course." "Oh, that explains it." And even then they knew, just, you know, just you meditate, your blood pressure goes way down and you're peaceful and healthy. So it should be relaxing the body. That's a sign you're doing something correct. And it's also the reason why I start people with being mindful and learning how to relax the body, is because that you can be pretty sure of when you're relaxed and when you're not relaxed. Because we're much more aware and experienced of our bodily feelings than we are of our mind. You may think you know your mind feelings, but that is for many people just unexplored territory. So we start relaxing the body, it feels really good, and you feel relaxed, and you feel the pleasure of relaxation, the pleasure gets you deeper, and because you are relaxed, you don't have to do anything. You just want to sit there and enjoy. In other words, it's the pleasure, the comfort, the contentment takes away the need to want anything, to will. It's how we learn how to let things be. It's nice. Why disturb it? So when you learn how to relax the body, then we go to the next, more important part. You know, the body comes and goes, but the mind, ooh, that's very difficult. Your mind. So, how can you relax your mind? Instead of always saying, "Come on, mind, relax, relax. How many times I've got to tell you, relax, mind? I'm telling you, relax." That's that little story. I'm sorry, but I cannot sort of avoid sort of telling bad old jokes. But that was of the, because there was a couple came the other day, celebrating their 60th wedding anniversary. It's amazing, 60 years married. And I told them the story, I read it in a magazine, about this other couple, 60 years they've been married. And of course, you know, that's very rare these days. You know, people get divorced so easily. And so they interviewed the couple, especially him, and said, what's the secret? How come you've been married for such a long time? He said, "Oh, it all started because, you know, I never argue with my wife. Never. Well, actually, I did twice, but that's all." I said, "How did you manage that?" He said, "Well, it happened on our honeymoon. Because on our honeymoon, we were honeymooning in the Grand Canyon. And we were both on little donkeys going down the trail into the canyon. And my wife's donkey stumbled. And she just looked at the donkey in the eye really fiercely, put up her finger and said, 'Donkey, that's the first time.'" I didn't know what she was up to, but, you know, just went a bit further, another couple of minutes, and the donkey stumbled again. And that's... that's where she looked the donkey in the eye a second time. "Donkey, that's the second time." And I was just, "No, what's going on?" I didn't know. And then when a few minutes later down the trail, the donkey stumbled a third time. This time, my wife never said anything. She just took out a gun and shot the donkey dead. And I asked, well, what did you do that for? And my wife looked at me, put up her finger and said, husband, that's the first time. I've never argued since. Anyway, where did I get into that one? What was I talking about? What's that got to do with meditation? 60
years.
Sorry?
60 years.
Yeah, but before that. Can I wind back a bit? I relax the mind, yes. Don't argue with it. Don't tell it what to do. So how you relax the mind? So, it's in the same way you can feel your body. Feel the mind. What do you mean, feel the mind? What is the mind? So there's many types of the mind. The mind is, you know what the mind is, in the same way you know what a garden is. You know it's a garden by what is found in the garden. In a garden you have trees, bushes, lawns, flowers, shrubs. That means it's a garden. You know the garden by what's there. So you know a mind by what's there. What lives in a mind? Frustration, anger, kindness, peace, fear, depression, contentment. Those are all the flowers and the weeds which live in a garden. So it's that area of your emotions, your thoughts. That's the area which we know there's a garden. So now, once you've got some idea of what we're talking about, the next thing is to ask yourself, how peaceful is my mind? And I did this little exercise the first night. How peaceful are you right now? And be honest, because no one is going to know. It just, it's for your own benefit. You say, how peaceful am I from 1 to 10? How peaceful are you right now? The number you give is not so important as the fact it makes you be aware of this thing we call the mind. And especially that quality of your mind, which is what, you know, we're supposed to be working on and developing. Peace. So, how are you peaceful? How much so? Really peaceful? Not so peaceful? Be honest, don't be embarrassed. Sometimes that things happen in life and we have to get very agitated. So, how peaceful are you? Now, just like with your body, you know how to relax the body. What makes the body more tense? What makes it loosen up and get all nice and relaxed and warm and comfortable? What makes your mind peaceful? What makes it agitated? You can see straight away when I speak slowly, your mind calms down. But when I start speaking fast with a high-pitched tone, then your mind starts getting very agitated because you don't know what's going to happen next because it's very exciting and very fearful. Can you notice the difference? Now, why did I do that little simile? It's because there are times when you think so fast that really agitates your mind. So one way of calming your mind down is deliberately, if you have to think slowly. If you have to think like I am speaking with spaces between each little segment. So, don't think too fast. Sometimes people complain to me that when I'm speaking, especially when I'm telling a joke, because sometimes I know the ending, I can't wait to get to the ending because I laugh at my own jokes, which is one of the reasons I tell them, and because I laugh at my own jokes, sometimes when I'm speaking fast like this, people can't understand what I'm saying because I'm speaking too fast. So, It's nice to deliberately think slowly and put pauses between the words. Now, when you're doing this to yourself, then you find you do actually calm down. It's an old little trick which is very helpful, is that whenever somebody argues with you, it could be your boss, your partner, whoever else it is, you know, in your life, and they're shouting at you, and you know, sometimes you wonder, why me? What have I done wrong? And sometimes, instead of as soon as they stop speaking, you sort of start yelling back at them. Why are you saying this to me? I'm trying really hard. I really work hard in this place. And he shouts back at you, and she shouts back. And that's not the way to solve any argument. If you can remember to do this, if somebody really screaming and shouting at you, then after they've finished, give them 1 minute of silence. Look at them. And give them 1 minute before you start to speak. Because in that 1 minute of silence, they have the opportunity to reflect on what they've said. Otherwise, they don't know what they've said at all. Just blah, 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 blah. And then you go, blah, 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 back. And then the opportunity's lost. But imagine they're shouting. You just hold it for 30 seconds. You do 30 seconds. That's not bad. 1 minute's really good. And then they have an opportunity. The only thing they can do is to reflect, to be mindful of what they've said and how inappropriate it was. And that actually is a very good circuit breaker. But it's also the circuit breaker for your thinking mind. Blah, 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 blah. You're shouting to yourself in your mind, thinking. And then you decide just to have a pause. So you can reflect on what you've been thinking about. And how unimportant it all was. And how it doesn't resolve the problems. It's one of the great insights. We call it the wisdom born of silence. Many of the difficult problems in life, we assume we can get to the bottom of them, we can solve them through thinking. But honestly, just in all your life, how many problems have you solved through thinking? They just make more problems. You assume you've got a good answer, but it's not that deep. But there is the other way of solving the problem, which is, you know, through silence. You feel the answer. A good example of that is when I was in Norway at Oslo University, just giving a talk, and at question time, this young woman put up her hand just about finding answers to important problems in life. She said, if I've got a very important problem to solve, you know, really it's just, you know, which will change my life whichever way I go, how do I solve those problems? And she was sitting next to a young guy, and so I added one and one up and made a perfect score of two. I said, well, let's make it a little bit more grounded in reality. Instead of any old problem, suppose the problem is, should I marry the boy sitting next to me? And I shouldn't do these things, but you know that she pulled her head in her face, went bright red, because that was a problem. She had a proposal and she had to decide whether to accept it or not. So you should ask questions like that of a monk, because sometimes we get it right away. And so, okay, it's an important decision to make. Should I marry that guy or not? You know, it could be just a wonderful experience in your life, or it could be just like hell on earth, and you don't really know until you commit. So that's one of the reasons why it's a very difficult decision to make. So it's such an important decision in your life, I said, the best way to decide is toss a coin. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. She laughed, and a lot of times people laugh and think, oh, Ajahn Brahm is just so superficial. You know, he's just telling jokes all the time, he doesn't know. But it's not a joke. There's something very deep comes from that. You toss a coin. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. The point is, once that coin falls and starts moving and you see it's heads, heads I marry him, how do you feel? If you think, yes. Or do you feel, let's try 2 out of 3. What it does, it gets you in touch with a wisdom which is, you can't reach through thinking. The wisdom of intuition, of silence. That's what you're getting in touch with. Should I become a monk? Heads I become a monk, tails I don't. Heads.
Yes.
Tails. 2 out of 3. So that tells you, deep inside, how you're feeling, the reaction you have. So this is where the wisdom of silence can actually access that. And your brain, your mind is an incredible device, and if you can let it find answers, it's amazing how it will find great answers. So, I think I told a few of the Jhana Groovies who were here just recently, that not far from here, we've got what we call the secret garden. And if you want to know where the secret garden is, you can get a plan, directions. It's somewhere around, down that way somewhere. But anyway, that there is a little Bodhi tree there, and it was planted for a lady, a Thai lady, who, she was a top social worker, and one of her jobs was she had to get all the information of a family to see whether it was the correct decision to take the children away from their parents because of abuse. And these were young children, maybe with a single mother. And you can't just take children away from the mother just like that. It had to be for the children's best interest. And the children were going to suffer, the mother was going to suffer, it would be very traumatic, but sometimes you had to do that to save the child. Because maybe the mum was a drug addict or was alcoholic or was in such serious difficulties. And she had to be the one who made those decisions. High stress. So anyway, one of those retreats, she finished work late to the retreat, and at least she had the experience, the training to let things go, to put them down, to be peaceful. So she forgot all about those problems which she would face when she went back to work, when she was meditating. And after a while, first of all, get rid of the sleepiness, the tiredness from the stressful job, and then started meditating, becoming peaceful, smiling. And then she came up to me in one of the interviews and said, "Ajahn Brahm, it's amazing. I haven't thought about work for about 4 or 5 days. And then I was sitting there really peaceful, and then all these solutions came up by themselves. I never thought about them. They just popped up from nowhere. And these were really good solutions to some very difficult problems." She just wrote them all down when she got back to her room and then carried on meditating afterwards. She said, I'll implement them when I go back to work. And so often that's been the case, that the best solutions, for the deepest problems, they come when you're not thinking about it. When you let it go, you meditate, and they come from themselves. The reason I say that, because it is encouraging and giving you confidence. You don't have to think through difficult problems. Just put all that thinking aside, be peaceful, and you'll find the problems get solved. The answers just come. So, and for anyone who wants to know just how amazing that can be, there was one fellow at Cambridge called Brian Josephson who invented the Josephson Junction. It's just quantum tunneling at close to absolute zero temperatures, which is it was the most important discovery which allowed supercomputing to occur. And of course, he got a Nobel Prize for that. the only Welsh person who's ever got a Nobel Prize for physics. And he imagined that he got that insight when he was meditating. For meditation, he got his Nobel Prize. True. That's the deep insight. He'd obviously done all the background stuff, but the real breakthrough, just meditate, not think about anything, and it comes up. So this is why you can trust the wisdom of silence. So when you're actually meditating, what's it like when you're thinking? How peaceful are you? What's it like when you're relaxing, you're not thinking? You get far more peaceful. Number two is that you're agitated. Why? What causes you're agitating? A lot of times because you are striving for something. You want something. Imagine something you really want right now. You can see the mind sort of tense up as it sort of tries to get ready to, how can I get this? How can I achieve this? How can I manage to sort of make this, you know, my goal a reality? You get tense and tight like that. Instead, imagine you've got no more goals. So now I'm going to do a little guided meditation for you to introduce this. So, as you're sitting, just only a very short one, a 10-minute one this time, to what it's like when there's no striving and how peaceful you can become. Only 10 minutes. So sitting down, close your eyes. Just relax the body as best you can. Feel the body. As you start with my legs. Legs, how are you down there? When I've got my eyes closed, I can feel them. It's almost like having a conversation with my legs. Hey, how are you? And the legs will tell me, actually, they're not bad. Buttocks, how are you? My buttocks, okay for 10 minutes, but if I was going to meditate for longer than that, I'd push the cushion further in. So how are your buttocks now? And if they say, can you just adjust me a little bit? Just adjust. Your back, how's your back now? Thank you for asking, said my back. Because it just needed a little bit of stretching. My hands, how are you? Yeah, that's good, down there. My shoulders. The neck, head. So when I ask questions, get an answer, it's a method, a skillful means of arousing mindfulness. An example, how's your stomach now? Now you can feel your stomach. You're aware, mindful. Any kind, just relax. So asking a question is a means of arousing mindfulness in the area which you ask. And just sitting here, you've just been aware of your body, relaxed it. Now, I'm going to ask you to use your powers of imagination, visualization. Imagine you're the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, already enlightened. You can hear the birds chirping, just the cool of the little meadow by the river Nirantara. The air is still. You're just sitting. You've achieved everything that has to be achieved. Enlightenment is there. There's no more wanting, no more craving, nothing which can be added. Even words cannot improve upon the silence. You are just there, at peace, like a worker who has finished the job, is now retired, does not need to work again, content with nothing to do, at peace, healthy, free. No problems about money, no problems about health, nothing to strive for anymore. Just like when a person finished university, all that hard work finished, ended. Unfortunately for those in the world, there's more tests waiting in the future. But for the Buddha, there's nothing more to be done. So you can just relax to the max. No need to fix anything up. No more to add onto what's already here. Utter, complete perfection. Just being in this world until the time comes the body falls apart, leaves forever. A job well done. Nothing more to add. Imagine that's you. No more problems. No more anxieties. Nothing more to prove. No more work to complete. No deadlines. You are free, unburdened from the past, unharassed by the future. Free to be, because you've done everything which could ever be done. Peace. At last. It wasn't 10 minutes, it was only 8 minutes. But I thought 8 is a very good number. Fine. So do you get the idea, the message there? When you relax, and if you really get into it, interestingly enough, that little method I developed, you know, just from one day going into Singapore, and it was, you know, there's a little kindergarten, the Little Gems, kindy. So I said, oh, can you go up there and just teach the little kids? They said, yeah, okay, we need to try anything once, sometimes only once. And then these were little kids, I mean, 4 or 5 year old. You know, you can't sit there and teach people dependent origination and the importance, you know, the real meaning of upadana, you know, to 4 or 5 year olds. Oh, what am I going to do with these? But it was close to Waisak, so that's why they invited me. It's, you know, Waisak season, just tell them about Waisak. So you can tell them about Waisak. The Buddha was born and took 7 steps because it was his last life. And what does that mean to kids? Or the Buddha was under the Bodhi tree, and in the first watch of the night understood, I've got the 4 jhanas first of all, the deep meditations, what are jhanas? And that's not going to do much to 4 or 5 year olds. So one thing I did remember when I was that age was that we always used to do these visualization imaginations. One thing I remember at school was closing your eyes, putting your arms out, imagine you're a tree waving in the wind. And to this day, I remember that. You close your eyes, you're a real tree waving in the wind, bending this way. And so I said, okay. So, now, kids, the first event of Waistak, the birth of the Buddha. As soon as you come out of the mum's womb, you take 7 steps. So, okay, imagine you just come out of your mum's womb. They didn't know what that really meant. So 7 steps, I took 7 steps and put one finger up. No, not the middle one, this finger. Say, this is my last life. I am the best in the world. And they enjoyed doing that. That was easy to get them to do that. Okay, that's the Buddha's birth. The next one, sitting under the Bodhi tree, enlightened. Got them all sitting down with their hands in their laps, back straight. Just imagine they were Buddha. It's amazing how well they could do that. I had them sitting there for I don't know how long. You tell them to sit still and be quiet, they can't do that. You tell them to watch their breath, no way. But to be able to just imagine you're the Buddha. They did that and they got a taste of peace, which was incredible. And then, okay, the next one. It wasn't actually Waistak Day when the Buddha gave his first sermon, so I passed that one. Because if I asked them to give a sermon, they would be really talking too loud. So the last one, the Buddha's Parinibbana. So lie on the right side. So I told them how to lie with the head on the right arm, just right leg over the left leg, sitting still, laying down still there. And they enjoyed that as well. Because they actually felt something, they were doing something. But the heart of it was just imagine they were Buddha under the Bodhi tree. I thought, if kids can do that, why can't we? And you get a feeling for it. You know what's happening, you're imagining, you're feeling it, instead of thinking about it. If you're thinking about doing it, you know, thinking about watching your breath, it gets all complicated, just feel it. And it brings me up to that breath meditation technique, absolutely brilliant. Whoever invented this, sadhu to them. There was this guy who just could not watch his breath. Tried, watching your breath, maybe one or two breaths, breathing in, breathing out, and this just all went wrong. So this teacher said, okay, just sit down. Just imagine that you could watch the breath. Imagine what it'd be like to be sitting down here watching every breath go in, every breath go out. Just imagine it. Just visualize it. Just know that some people can actually do that. They can actually watch the breath for long periods of time. So imagine what it would be like. So he said, okay. So he shut his eyes and he just imagined watching the breath. And after about 5 minutes, the teacher said, what are you watching? He said, my breath. It was just a psychological detour to get past this stupid roadblock, I can't do it, and habits, bad habits. So after a while, we get to know our mind. And once it's nice and peaceful, and we can actually feel it, don't just think it, feel it. Feel what it's like to be peaceful. Once you feel peace, here's another little sort of skillful means. I'm going to say a word. After I say the word, just hold it there. Just let it be with you. Don't sort of try and interpret it. Don't try and work out what the heck this means. Don't analyze it or take notes. Just let it be. See what happens. Peace. 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 Oh, well. Okay. I want to keep going on like that, but I should say some more. It's supposed to be a talk. In these talks, sometimes if you don't say anything, it's like people who listen to this afterwards think there's something wrong with the machine. It was like, I remember in Media Corp, who was that? I think you took me there, that gentleman, he only had one arm, and he was in Uncommon Sense, was it?
Mel Gill.
Oh, what's his name?
Mel Gill.
Mel Gill, that's right, yeah. They invited me up there once, and I knew enough about radio. If you are silent for more than, I think, was it 30 seconds, you get fined? Well, you know, the show gets fined because, you know, people don't know whether the transmission has broken down or not. So that's when I told one of my jokes. And he just, he cracked up totally. He fell off his chair. And he was on the ground. Did you were there, weren't you? I think you saw that one?
No, I didn't see it.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah. He cracked up his other, and he was just, he couldn't speak. He was just gesticulating to me because I know that, you know, I had to start speaking or say something. Otherwise, he'd be in big trouble for not performing. But, you know, sometimes the silence is just amazing. You say peace, and you can write a book about peace. You can get a Nobel Prize, Peace Prize. But do you really know what peace is? When you just say those things, and you listen afterwards, you can actually start to feel peace. You know what it actually is. And it's so hard to put into words. The words, whenever you have peace and you try to describe it, oh, crickets, you never actually reach what that word truly describes, truly means. That's why you know that sometimes it's great poets. You know, sometimes I used to read poetry when I was young, and sometimes a poet just had a gift, a miracle with words, and they could, a few words, and they just, they got it, they described something which, you know, was just so hard for you to put into language. And that's why the great poets, you know, sometimes you admired them. Sometimes it was just by luck, by fortune, but when they got it, wow, that was amazing. So this is why that some of these things like peace, silence, freedom, contentment, the really beautiful words, love, compassion, openness, those, the thoughts destroy them. They don't sort of describe them. Which is one of the reasons why when we meditate and we become aware of our mind, don't destroy and desecrate things like peace, like silence. Did you hear the silence? Well, there's no words. That gets you deep inside. So, these are how we learn how to bring our peaceometer way down, close to one. So peaceful. And you don't have a technique to do this. It's not watching your breath or what doing vipassana or doing metta meditation. It's all the same. It's all how to let it be. You cannot make peace. Peace is already there. It's what happens when you stop interfering and making comments. You only disturb the peace. You never make the peace. Peace is already there, it's default state. So all we need to do is just to shh, let it be. Be still. Stop interfering. Sit and close your eyes, imagine the Buddha. And peace is there when you're not trying to achieve something else. Now you're getting into your meditation. You're sitting here and I'm peaceful. Blown it. Don't describe it. Don't try and take a photograph of what's happening. Sometimes when you get wonderful things happen in life, peace, stillness, Why is it we want to capture it? These are like rare species of birds. You can't capture them and put them in a cage and show them off in the zoo. You know, these are part of the world which needs to be free. When I mentioned I went on a pilgrimage to India when I was 20. 20? Yeah, I think 20. You know, I thought, okay, I'm going to settle down now, get a job, get married, so I'm not going to be able to go travelling much afterwards. I'm a Buddhist, I should go on pilgrimage, so I decided to go on pilgrimage, get all the travelling out of my system. I've been travelling even more since then. So anyway, got to India, and one of the things I wanted to do was to see the Himalaya Mountains. Have you seen the Himalaya Mountains? They're impressive, a huge mountain stretching over the horizon with all the history and stuff in Buddhism and stuff and all the amazing people who would levitate over the Himalayas and the Nagas and the dragons who would live there and stuff. Even Yetis. Do you believe in Yetis? Is it just a myth? But anyway, it's weird that sometimes, you know, you think, that's just superstition. But when I was over in Bhutan, the guide, he was very highly educated. He lived half the year in, I think, San Francisco or Los Angeles, and the other half in Bhutan. He would take people around on tours. That was his business, very lucrative. So just, you know, I was a mug, and after a while, he got to respect me. And then I just asked him when I realised, you know, he was, you know, not going to treat me like, you know, like a tourist. I was a monk, a senior monk. And then I asked him, he said, you know, are there any Yetis in Bhutan? And without sort of even any hesitation, oh, yeah. Are you sure? He said, yeah, in my house we have a Yeti skin. It's supposed to be good luck, good fortune. So my father, it's not very nice, killed a Yeti. And you know, he was serious about this. And so, yeah, there are, but they're very remote, very hard to see. But they're up, you know, in the very, he said in the north part of Bhutan. Straight away I said, oh, can we go there? Said, no, it takes days and weeks of trekking to get, you know, to where they are. And we don't like to disturb them. Amazing stuff happening. And of course, you know, Ajahn Brahm, there he goes again. But no, that's not a joke. That's what his soul told me. So anyway, you see this big, vast Himalaya mountain stretching from the whole horizon. And I always wanted, I saw photographs of them. That's one of the things I'm going to do. See the four holy places and then also go and see the Himalayas. And as soon as I got there, I realized I should have done my research. It was monsoon season. It was clouds every day. He couldn't see sort of, you know, the distance at all. It was all cloudy. It was, you know, monsoon season. It was like the August, September, October. So I thought, oh no, I should have done research. Oh, I forgot about that and just did other things. But then one day, up in Nepal, just I was with a couple of others and there was this little, I was a poor student, the post van would go from Kathmandu right up to the border with Tibet, and it was illegal, but you know, they would take a couple of students for, you know, a few rupees in the back, you know, just, you know, because it was no extra work for them, and he would get a bit of extra money and we could actually see some of the countryside. So when we got really close to the border, then he stopped for his lunch, and together with his two Americans, there was a little hill, and just, let's climb the hill just to see what's on top. So we climbed the hill, and as soon as we got to the top of the hill, the clouds broke and you could see the Himalaya Mountains. The whole range, the first time in 2 or 3 months. And there they all were. It was breathtaking. You know what I did? Ran down to the van to get my camera. I did that. Stupid, stupid, stupid. I was supposed to be intelligent, going to a good university. Stupid, stupid, stupid. And I ran up as fast as I could. In those days, I was very fit, really fast. And as soon as I got up to the top, it closed at that moment. you know, if... And then the two men said, where did you go? And it was a really good teaching for me, because it showed that the really incredible Dhamma's beauty, you just cannot capture them. They're impossible. So whenever you get into a deep meditation, even a little bit of peace, don't try and photograph it, name it, describe it to yourself. You destroy it. Let it be. You're sitting here and you get peaceful. Beware of describing it, of putting it in a prison, in a cell. Let it be free. Then it might come again. At least it will last much longer. You learn how to let things be. So then you find your mind gets really peaceful and can stay peaceful. Otherwise it gets peaceful and then you say, this is really good. I'm going to go and tell somebody about this. You destroyed it again. So just let it be peaceful. You can't take notes, you can't describe it, you can't just take a photograph of it, you can't record it on your cell phone, you can't sort of take a neurological picture of it on a CT scan or whatever. You just leave it. It's peaceful. And then you find these are little tricks, and you find it takes a piezometer to zero, or to one, sorry. And you find all of this. You can see this yourself whenever you say, oh, sounds so easy. I'm going to do this. Ajahn Brahm explained it. It's so easy. Anyone can do this. Anyone can do this. But very few people will, but you can. There's a lot of difference between a person can do it and they will do it. Sometimes they just put too many obstacles in their way. So, but anyway, when you are meditating, you feel your mind getting peaceful. You will find that trying to capture things, another way of controlling, doesn't work. It disturbs the mind. Bring strategies and striving. You'll notice when you want something, you always think about how you're going to get it. It's like more thoughts, more strategies, and it just disturbs your peace. And if you get into thinking and describing, then you go into the past. The last time I got this is what I did, but the other time it didn't work because somebody did this. And you get into all so much negativity and bitterness. Please know that you never own peace. You can never capture it and call it yours. It is selfless, which is one of the reasons why just my life always got too many responsibilities. And so it was the case that on just outside the range retreat, it's going to happen again soon, on the weekends, I go over to our city centre, Nodamara, to teach and to help and to serve and to counsel and to do so much. And then come back on Sunday evening and Monday to Friday, just work in Bodhinyana Monastery or here. You know, I've got to work two jobs. I've got a weekend job and a week job and a few other things on the side as well. And so it got to the point one day, on a Monday, I was just walking with a visitor over in Bodhinyana Monastery, and the visitor said, oh, this is such a peaceful, beautiful monastery. You're so lucky to live in Bodhinyana. Have you been over there yet? Some of you have, you haven't. It's going to be there tomorrow as well. You don't have to go today. It's such a beautiful place. And I looked at them and said, are you joking? Beautiful, peaceful, tranquil. You don't live here. You don't all have all these crazy monks to look after. You don't have all these Anagarikus who want this or want that. You don't have all this business to do. You don't have all of this... And I started thinking to myself, hang on. This gentleman, a visitor, could really appreciate and enjoy the monastery where I lived. And for me, it was like a work camp. It was my office. It was my job. And I thought, I'm missing out. I built this place, but other people enjoy it, and I don't. Something is very wrong there. So you know what I did? I decided, Monday morning, can't do it every Monday morning or Tuesday or whatever, one afternoon a week, I will pretend to be a visitor, just like you. So you go over there, you don't have to worry about if the monks are misbehaving or if the water is leaking or if the gutters are overflowing or if there's no electricity. You don't have to worry about that. It's not your problem. You're only a visitor. But if I'm the abbot, I have to worry about that. So I decided one afternoon a week I'll be a visitor to the monastery where I live. So someone will come up to me, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, you know, there's a problem. I said, I'm not Ajahn Brahm today, I'm a visitor. Ajahn Brahm, I really need to talk to you about my meditation. What do you mean talk to me? I'm a visitor, I don't know anything about meditation. Ajahn Brahm, you know, when I was a visitor, not an owner, not a boss, I could really appreciate the place where I lived. It was actually a very beautiful monastery. When you don't own it. It's very peaceful when you're not the boss. It's very tranquil when you don't have to be a teacher and disturb the silence by giving all these talks and advice. So I decided to be a visitor. People came out to me and said, not my problem today, I'm only visiting. I'm a visiting monk. And then it got so peaceful and tranquil. And he got some great understanding of how to get your mind to be peaceful. You don't really own your mind. You're only visiting. I'm only visiting today. Mind if you're going crazy, if you're having sort of really psychotic thoughts. Okay, I'm only visiting. Not my problem. It's not my job. Your body, really sick. I'm only visiting today. It's amazing. You let go when you don't own it. Not me, not mine, not a self. So, see if you cannot own your meditation. Meditation. It's not my practice. It's not my meditation. So if you don't do that, it's nobody's meditation. So just sit here. Great. Not my problem anymore. Hey, imagine that. You don't have to worry about how crazy you are. It's a doctor's problem. You sort it out. But imagine that. What you're doing is you're letting go. And your peaceometer goes, ooh, down to one. Nothing to do. So these are little inspirations on how to not just get your body to be still, how to get your mind, or rather the mind in which you're hanging out with for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. How to make peace with it, or actually how to allow it to be peaceful. And then, because it's naturally peaceful, that's its default state, said Ajahn Chah, your job is to get out of the way and let it be. Sadhu. 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 May you have a wonderful morning, and there's a few interviews, but I have to finish this at 10 o'clock. So, interviews for those who want to be. Actually, I should really call it what it's probably. It's not interviews, it's interrogations. I learned a few things when I was in Korea a few days ago, and then get a few techniques, interrogation techniques. No, I'm only joking. I'm very kind.